Lovely paid subscribers, thank you so much for supporting the show. Much more to come. As always, I'm working on an episode on Marquis de Sade right now.
No darkness there.
Frankly, I'm uncomfortable all the time now, right now, as I'm reading this.
More than usual, I'm sure.
And I'm realizing as I put together my notes that, oh man, there's some of this I'm not sure if I want to say it out loud. But
cool.
We'll get there. We'll talk about it.
Well, yeah. And I'm working on the slightly more benign F. Scott Fitzgerald Part 2, following on our live show, our first live show that we did. And I cannot wait to do Houdini live here in Detroit later this year. It's going to go fast. It's just March now. It'll be October in no time. And if you can make it out, October 26th, Hamtramck, Michigan. Gonna be a good time.
Yeah.
And Kate is back here to talk more wild. I've got a couple of things to kind of guide the conversation, but first I just want to say thanks again, Kate. That was brilliant. And you're, as a scholar, it's just so listening to you as a scholar just extemporaneously talk about all these various things. It reminds me that school wasn't all bad. I had some good times. I had some very good professors in my in my time. I saw too that you are a visiting professor in Korea as well.
Yeah, at Ewha Women's University. Yeah. I'm going there in a couple of weeks actually. So yeah, well, I think school should be fun. I mean, and I mean that's the problem, isn't it? That sometimes we get so caught up with things that are serious. And I think actually you asked me before what my favorite Wilde quote was. And actually, the thing that really stayed with me and I think really means something to me and how I think about the world is that Wilde said, life is too important a thing ever to be taken seriously. And I think if you really do think very hard about whatever it is, whether it's really serious things about poverty or economics and politics, is actually you have to have a little bit of levity too, because it's too much otherwise. So I think that's probably my favorite Wilde quote. I got there eventually.
I love that. Yeah,
and we say on this pod all the time, we laugh so we don't cry. Because sometimes, sometimes we'll get a little criticism, you know, oh, they're talking about these serious topics and they're always laughing at their own jokes. It's like, well, one, there are two hosts. So who other jokes are we going to laugh at? You know what I mean? So it's a little bit like, you got to be able to laugh, or life's going to life's painful enough without it.
That's right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that kind of distance to be able to laugh at yourself in really difficult situations is necessary. You need to have perspective, right? You need to have perspective. Otherwise, things become very difficult, or it becomes impossible, and you need that kind of that distance in order to be able to function, I think.
Yeah.
Well, and I think we're going to need to laugh a little bit here about these two darkroom pieces I have. Okay. So we typically go after some pretty salacious stuff for the After Dark, rather, here for the patrons. This is a 22-year-old post from The Guardian. So this post is of age. This is you and Kate, you probably know all of this, but for the purpose of the conversation and our listeners, here's the name of the article. Wilde's sex life exposed in explicit court files. I'm going to read a few paras of this. Explicit documents prepared for the Oscar Wilde libel case have come to light, offering a revealing new glimpse of the double life led by the celebrated Irish writer. The shocking witness statements, previously unseen, were drawn up by employees at Day Russell of the Strand, solicitors for the defense in Wilde's disastrous 1895 legal action against the Marquis. Am I saying that correctly? How would you pronounce that, Kate? Marquis? Marquis?
Marquis.
Marquis. Okay. Thank you. Marquis of Queensbury. Most of the papers were filed away and never used in court. While Wilde is remembered today as the dandy about town, sporting bespoke suits and habitually wearing a green carnation in his buttonhole, these statements from chambermaids, valets, bellboys, and even a lampwick seller portray his private life in lurid detail. Seedy descriptions of Wilde's bedroom are included in the damaging file, which was instrumental in Wilde's downfall and formed the background for one of the most famous cases in British legal history. Wilde took legal action against the Marquis, father of his lover, Lord Alfred Douglas, after he found a visiting card left by Queensberry at the Albemarle Club. It was inscribed with the words, "For Oscar Wilde, posing somnamite." That's a deep cut for the podcast. Yeah. We laughed and laughed about somnamites. Just a couple more paras here. And Kate's like, yes, yes, I know all this.
I love hearing it.
Yeah. Okay. Just a few more. And this is the Guardian. This is the sober, you know, Guardian. The 52 pages of statements from 32 witnesses have never been published and are handwritten on heavy sheets of paper. They were picked up in a London junk shop for a pittance during the 50s by a private collector whose widow is now selling them at Christie's on the 6th of June. This is early part of the century here. The historic bundle wrapped in pink string is expected to fetch £12,000, which at the time would have been about $25,000. Among the more sordid details are those revealed by Margaret Cotta, a chambermaid at the Savoy Hotel, a favorite rendezvous for Wilde and his series of young male renters. Describing a prolonged visit to the hotel by Wilde and Alfred Douglas, who was affectionately known as Bosey, Miss Cotta said she found a common boy, rough-looking, about 14 years of age, in Wilde's bed, the sheets of which were always in a most disgusting state with traces of Vaseline, soil, and semen. Ooh. Instructions were given that the linen should be kept apart and washed separately. Miss Cotta added that a stream of page boys delivering letters were usually kissed by Wilde, who then tipped them 2 shillings and 6 pence for their troubles. Okay. So there, and it goes on and on. This was not, there's some pretty gnarly stuff here. I mean, this, there was not nothing in this case. And Kate, I don't expect you to do an apologia for Wilde or run cover, but maybe we could use this as an entree to talk a little bit about that case and I guess you're thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't do an apologia for Wilde. I think that there's some very difficult issues that Wilde's case raises. And I think that a wonderful colleague of mine based in the US, Ellis Hansen, gave a wonderful paper a few years ago. And the title of the paper was, "Would We Convict Oscar Wilde Again?" And he addressed these issues and said, look, he's not a saint. We can't just say Wilde was a gay man and he was convicted because of this one law, the Labouchere Amendment in 1885, making it easier to convict someone for being gay. That was true, but also there was other stuff that the public today would not forgive him were it known, perhaps. The counter-argument to that is made by an academic, wonderful academic, and friend Joe Bristow, who's based at UCLA, who has a really marvelous book that should also be read on Oscar Wilde's trials. And it's The Last Word, I think, on Oscar Wilde's trials. It was published last year. And he argues that we will never know how many of these witnesses were paid.
To fabricate or
embellish their accounts. And I think that's absolutely true. I think what we have to say is we don't know. We don't know if Wilde used coercive behavior. He probably did. If he used his fame, I think he probably did. If he slept with underage boys, I think it's very possible indeed. Sexual politics were very different then. It was as subversive and also as delicious, probably, to transgress a boundary of age as it was to transgress a boundary of sex. The question for us, I think, now is whether we would convict Oscar Wilde again, whether we would forgive him, whether we forgive Wilde, but we read Wilde's works, but we don't watch Woody Allen. Is he or someone else, anyone else? Harvey Weinstein films. is Wilde more forgivable because he's further back, because he's sort of off our moral radar by being so long ago? And if he is, then maybe we shouldn't judge other people, other artists morally as well. But that feels wrong, and that feels weird too, maybe. I think we live in some ways, though, in a new Puritanism, in the age of a new Puritanism, where we want to judge morally. We want to say this person's good, that person's bad. We'll watch these films, we won't watch those films. Where that takes us in terms of our, I don't know, imposing morality on artists, filmmakers, I don't know, but I think it's a question that we need to ask ourselves as well as individuals.
Yeah,
it's almost impossible to be consistent with any of this, because if you are, we're going to have to lose the Beatles, we're going to have to lose Led Zeppelin, we're going to have
so
to
many
lose Bowie, yeah, we're going to have to lose rhythm and blues.
Where is the line? I mean, sure, being a predator on underage people, that's pretty obvious, but you get to the point where, what if this person was just kind of an asshole? Like, is that what is enough of a transgression that they get
right? They voted the wrong way or something. Yeah,
something like that. Yeah,
and like, I have a private theory that a lot of it is economic, right? It's you said in the primary episode, Kate, that people feel like it's too expensive now to be decadent, and of course that's, you know, and then so you see someone else having more pleasure than you and seeming to get away with it. Well, there could be kind of a mean-spirited desire to knock the other person down. They look like they're having too much fun on Maine.
Absolutely, the wrong kind of fun. The wrong kind of fun.
Right.
Ah, the wrong kind of fun. Yeah, when Brad brought up the aphorism question, I saw this. And this is just a website, you know, Wilde Online. Here's one of the things he said. It is most dangerous nowadays for a husband to pay any attention to his wife in public. It always makes people think that he beats her when they're alone. The world has grown so suspicious of anything that looks like a happy married life. I want to ask you a question too, and then I'll get into the second thing that I prepared for this. But Kate, what do you make of the relationship between Wilde and his poor, long-suffering wife?
I think that they had for a long time a happy marriage. I think that Wilde was a loving husband to begin with. He was probably bisexual. We like to call him gay now, but it wasn't just a lavender marriage. He didn't just marry her because he needed a cover. There's a lot of evidence that he really did love her, and they had a fully functioning love together.
This bisexual erasure will not stand on Art of Darkness, I'll tell you that much. Go on.
I think that he was in some ways, though, a bit of a misogynist. I think we see that in Dorian Gray. I think we see that in some of his plays as well. And some of the difficulty in Wilde, and in a sense, this is what we were talking about a moment ago too, is his contradictions. People aren't good or bad. No one is. And people don't transgress. And then they shouldn't be necessarily canned and damned forever because they're just bad people. People do bad things that don't define them completely. Wilde was not always nice to his wife. They ended up very unhappy, but they had a happy marriage as well. Mm. Both things are true. Wilde did things that we wouldn't agree with necessarily today, or a lot of people wouldn't. They might convict him again, I'm not sure, but he doesn't make him a bad person. I think so he had a functioning marriage. He had a happy marriage to Constance. She supported him, so she did support him, although she was unhappy with him, as you would be. I mean, he spent all the money. I mean, never mind the affairs. I mean, he spent all their money. Their house was
the unforgivable sin.
The unforgivable sin. Absolutely, absolutely. But she would, he had very high hopes that she would have let him see their children again. And then she died very tragically shortly after he left prison. So there was no sort of reconciliation possible. But it was potentially on the cards. She understood that he was a complex man who needed
different. And a genius. I'm sure she knew, she understood. I mean, a rare. I got another little quote.
She was an intellectual and a very, very big-hearted intellectual woman herself.
Here's another quote. This one's for you, Brad. Anyone can sympathize with the sufferings of a friend, but it requires a very fine nature to sympathize with a friend's success.
Isn't that the truth?
And I've got the second bit for the After Dark here, and this I just found this online real quick. We'll use it as another launching pad here. Clifton Snyder, English Department Emeritus, California State University, Long Beach, and this is it appears to be a paper on a very fine lavender background. Oscar Wilde, Queer Addict, biography and De Profundis. And there are a couple of paragraphs of introduction here, kind of about the way biographers have treated Wilde. And then he says, despite the weighty attention Wilde and his work have received, I agree with John Lahr's assertion, none of Wilde's biographers offer an interpretation of his self-destructiveness. Lahr adds, for that, one has to read between the lines of Wilde's wit. Yet, although Lahr cites a few lines of that famous wit, he doesn't begin to analyze Wilde's self-destructiveness. This I intend to do. I suspect biographers and critics have shied away from the subject for a number of reasons. Personal friendship with Wilde, self-protection, other aims, lack of knowledge and evidence, and political correctness. Queer critics in particular may not want to sully the reputation of one who is, after all, a gay icon. As a queer critic myself, I have no intention of tarring Wilde's reputation in the least. What I intend to do is uncover some of the reasons for Wilde's self-destructiveness, recognizing, as Wilde says, in Intentions, the full truth is unattainable. And he goes on a little bit here, but I want to get to the point about talking about the drinking. So let's see, one more caveat. When one writes about addictions, as I will, one writes about diseases. The issues are medical and psychological, not moral. The evidence suggests that Wilde was an alcoholic and a romance addict. We might say sex addict now. I don't know. Well, I mean, we're all romance addicts. I mean, please.
Right.
In literary studies, it is common to find authors who are alcoholic. Tell me about it. Indeed, sometimes being alcoholic seems to be a requirement to join the canon. As Donald W. Goodwin points out, of 7 American Nobel Prize winners, 5 were alcoholic. All jokes aside, Wilde, as a hard-drinking Irishman, that's a weird segue there. I wasn't seeing any jokes. Wilde, as a hard-drinking Irishman, might be expected to find the label alcoholic applied to him by his biographers routinely, but that has not been the case, perhaps because he was not the kind of alcoholic who literally ended up in the gutter, whether looking at the stars or not. Yet there is evidence that he was, if not an alcoholic in the stereotypical sense, then one who in his post-prison years used alcohol as a way to compensate for the spiritual vacancy he felt so keenly. Even before the debacle of 1895, there are stories, some by Wilde himself, of his overindulgence in spirits. He liked to tell the story about his experience with the miners of Leadville, Colorado, where he was lowered in a rickety bucket in which it was impossible to be graceful into a silver mine in order to have his supper. The first course being whiskey, the second whiskey, and the third whiskey. All right, so there you are. So we're just a little bit about Wilde and his drinking life and his addiction, you know, his addictive personality. I suppose we'll use this as a segue to ask Kate, what do you think about this? You mentioned in the primary part of this episode, not wanting to meet the sad Wilde at the end of his life, you know, crying into a bottle.
Yeah, I think you're right. And there are some very interesting points from what you raised. The first is self-destruction. And I think that really kicked in after he left prison. And remember, when he left prison, he'd spent 2 years in Reading jail, and he left in 1897. And he'd lost everything. He'd lost his lost his wife, his children. His mother had died. He didn't have any money. He didn't have any friends. He had nothing left in England. He didn't think that he could ever stay in England or go to Ireland, where he was born, which wasn't his home anymore anyway. So he ended up in self-imposed exile, traveling around Europe like a nomad for the last 3 years of his life, with really hardly any money a lot of the time, in search of something, in search of something to while away the time, in search of someone who he wasn't the person who he wasn't anymore and couldn't be again. He said that he wanted to write again, but he didn't think that he could write comedy because he just didn't have that sensibility anymore. He'd seen too much. I think that I think his self-destructiveness begins, though, is in seed form in his self-martyrdom. So the early 1890s, when we talked about Salome earlier on, and Salome was banned from public performance in London by the Lord Chamberlain's office, which had power of veto over things being performed on the London stage. And he was given lots of opportunities in a way to temper what he put in Salome, and he kind of wanted it to be banned. He wanted to be made an example of. I think he wanted the fame in a way. He said when he was a student, he reportedly said that he would be famous, and if not famous, notorious. What he did when he stood in the dock accused of acts of gross indecency in 1895, May 1895, he took to the dock to give evidence. And he implicated himself, as you know, he implicated himself by talking about, quote, the love that dare not speak its name between men. Mm-hmm. In other words, being gay. Mm-hmm. He knew that that would convict him. He actually was given the opportunity to leave the country before he was arrested, and he sat in the Cadogan Hotel and waited for the police officers to come because he didn't want to leave. He wanted to stand trial. He wanted to be made an example of. Now, in some ways, you could say, and in some ways, indeed, it was a very noble thing to do. He wanted to take the stand against this law and against prejudice and laws against men who desired other men. However, there's also an element, more than an element, I think, of self-destructiveness in that. He wanted to be the martyr. He was self-destroying himself, and he knew it. And when he went to prison, and this is much less known than the fact that he stood in the dock, when he went to prison, he realized how awful it was. He wrote lots of letters saying, I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it. Oh, I was mad. I was insane. Let me out. And so he had this destructive quality, and I think it was part of his creativity, part of a sort of live fast momentum and spirit that gave him his creativity, but also kind of hurtled him towards death, toward destruction. He couldn't live without thrills. In a sense, he became that self-destructive thrill seeker that he fictionalizes in Dorian Gray. He needed something sensual, something thrilling, something exciting to make him more himself. He sought that always, often in fame, in Hock and Seltzer, by the glass rather than by the bottle when he was younger. But then when he had nothing else, in a sense, to live for, I think it kind of took over.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
He stands out as such an individual.
Yeah.
I don't know if very few people will ever go from the highs that he had to the lows that he had. Just a very extreme situation. He's very sympathetic. And what's the name of that piece of writing about his time in the jail? De Profundis.
De Profundis, from the depths, which means from the...
Yeah. What an amazing piece of work that is.
It's beautiful. He's such a... Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely beautiful. And so De Profundis, it was given... It's a long letter, as you may know. It's a letter that he wrote to the man for whom he went to prison, Alfred Douglas. And it was given its title, De Profundis, by his executor, and closest friend, Robert Ross. So he didn't title it that. He copied it. He had the letter copied when he left prison. He gave one copy to Robert Ross and one copy to Alfred Douglas, who destroyed it.
Oh.
So imagine Alfred Douglas's shock, utter shock, when it then is published nearly 10 years after Wilde's death. He thought he'd destroyed the only copy.
Right.
No.
That's amazing.
Copy, yeah. Which implicates him in the destruction of Wilde.
Right. Wow. Wow.
But oof. I think you're right about Wilde being sympathetic. And here's what I think about that, is that I think that he is so sympathetic because he is, and you said because he's such an individual. I think he's so much himself, flawed, vulnerable, romantic, loving, brilliant. He's all of these contradictions all at once. And he's so, to use the terrible modern word, but it's right, he's so relatable in some ways. I think that he said, be yourself, everyone else is taken. And I think he is so much himself. I think in a way, whoever we are, I mean, none of us are geniuses like Wilde. Maybe you two are.
No, but
we can all be ourselves because we're better at being ourselves than at being anyone else. And I think that in a sense, I think that's one of the most beautiful things that Wilde gives us.
Yeah, I love it.
That's a fabulous way to finish. I really enjoyed this, Professor Hex. This is a real pleasure, Kate. We'll have you on for the episode that we do. Brad and I will cover that subject, and we'll have you back on for a dark room.
That'd be wonderful.
You're welcome anytime.
Alan Asimova. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. And congrats on the book. Looks thank wonderful. You.
Yeah, we'll be promoting this episode, obviously, but we'll be promoting that book as hard as we can in our little platform.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I'll retweet you and I'll keep following the Art of Darkness podcast. I love the things that you do.
Thanks. So
it's really lovely. I've been browsing through your episodes.
Oh, great. Well, wonderful. Awesome.
All right. Thank you so much. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.